thinking of action.
All rise. The judges of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States in this honorable court.
Please be seated. The court is called to order. The court calls the case of United States versus Airman Cayman J. Scalufo, number ACM 39539. In today's oral argument, we consider whether the findings of guilty of charge one and its specification are legally and factually sufficient, and whether the military judge abused his discretion in failing to order a new trial on the grounds of newly discovered evidence. Appellant's counsel, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, we've asked to reserve 7 minutes, please.
7 minutes, very well. You may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Senior Judge Johnson, members of the court. I'm Zachary Spillman. Major Hoffman and I represent the appellant, Airman Scalufo. May it please the court. Airman Scalufo's convictions are based entirely on the credibility of the alleged victim, Senior Airman M.S. If her testimony is disbelieved, and it should be disbelieved due to the many inconsistencies, contradictions, and outright lies in her testimony, then the evidence is insufficient to support any of the findings of guilt in appellant's case. Now, in this case, new evidence bearing on Senior Airman MS's credibility was discovered post-trial, and the defense asked the military judge to consider whether the new discovery, if considered in light of all the other pertinent evidence, would probably produce a substantially more favorable result for Airman Scalufo. The military judge refused to do so, abusing his discretion with clearly erroneous findings of fact, an incorrect view of the law, and a decision outside the range of choices reasonably available. The remedy for that failure is reversal and a new trial. Alternatively, this court should set aside the findings and sentence due to the other errors, including the factual insufficiency of the evidence to prove Airman Scalufo's guilt of any offense, and the legal insufficiency of the conviction for wrongful use of marijuana. Now, the military judge abused his discretion when he denied the defense motion for a new trial. A motion for a new trial is considered under Rule for Courts Martial 1210F2, which states a three-part test for whether new evidence warrants a new trial. And those parts are, first, that the evidence was discovered after the trial. Second, that the evidence is not such that it would have been discovered at the time of trial by the exercise of due diligence by the defense. And third, that the newly discovered evidence, if considered by a court-martial in light of all other pertinent evidence, would probably produce a substantially more favorable result for the accused. Now, in this case, the evidence was discovered after the trial. That's the first prong. The evidence that was discovered was evidence that Senior Airman MS was a recreational user of marijuana and cocaine, and it was also discovered that she obstructed justice by asking another airman to cover up her drug habit. That was, we assert that that was new evidence, meeting the first prong of RCM 1210F2. But the military judge refused to apply the rule, concluding that it wasn't. Considering only the urinalysis results and not considering the potential obstruction of justice, the military judge ruled, and this is Appellate Exhibit 22 at page 4, he ruled, I find that these are not newly discovered evidence within the meaning of RCM 1210F2A, because they occurred after trial. As such, any remaining analysis under RCM 1210F2 would be inapplicable. And then he did not do any more analysis under that rule. And the military judge applied a categorical rule. Because the events occurred after trial, the military judge categorically rejected them as new evidence. The government division offers the same categorical approach to this court in its brief. It writes, evidence of events happening after trial is not newly discovered evidence. That's the government division's brief at 29. The government division and the military judge are both wrong. Events occurring after trial can be newly discovered evidence under RCM 1210F2. And there are three clear examples of that from precedent that were cited in our reply brief on page 17. The first was United States versus Giambra.
In all three of those cases, however, counsel, they pertain to misconduct that directly related to what happened at trial. There were people, there was one case, I believe, where the person had been paid potentially for their testimony, another one who had actually actively covered up an affair that she was having, and I think conspired with one of the other participants in the trial to do so. In this case, we have your analyses that occur after trial. I'm not sure that I understand the link between the three cases you cite and how they support your argument here today.
Thanks for that question, Your Honor, because the linkage is important, but the linkage is the third part of the test. Right? So we have a three-part test. First, new evidence, then essentially clean hands by the defense, and finally, the probability of producing a substantially more favorable result to the accused. The linkage, what the evidence proves and how it could be used, is the third part of the test, which the military judge never did. Now, we think in this case, the second prong, the fact that the defense couldn't have discovered this, is either conceded or undeniable, because
well, it hadn't
defense
occurred yet.
Well, that's
so
true.
There is no way they could have found out about it. I think that that's probably not really the issue. I think the issue is, how do you use misconduct that occurs after trial to relate back to the trial itself? So I understand your argument. You're saying that the victim, in this case, his credibility can be attacked by the post-trial misconduct, which leads me to the next question of, why is that not just mere impeachment evidence?
Even if it is mere impeachment evidence, Your Honor, there's nothing in the rule that prevents a new trial based on mere impeachment evidence. Now, in the Government Division supplemental citations, they offer a number of cases, some federal and some military, that say that mere impeachment evidence alone is not enough. We'd ask the court to consider two things on that. The first is that the federal cases are in opposite because they're applying a different rule. They're applying Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 33, which is different. And they're applying, for instance, the first case they cite, United States versus Thompson out of the 11th Circuit, uses a five-part test, one part of which is that the evidence is not merely cumulative or impeachment. And so it's a different rule and a different test, and it just doesn't apply here. Now, they do cite some military cases, specifically Dyer and Thomas. Thomas is from 1981. The 1984 manual for courts martial is where we get rule for courts martial 1210. There was no such rule. There was no three-part test before 1984. So Thomas didn't address this rule at all. Dyer's from 1986, but every citation in that case is to the 69 manual. They don't address RCM 1210 either. What's interesting, though, is that this court addressed the issue just a little over 2 years ago, in February of 2017. It's an unpublished case, I'm sorry about that, but it was an Article 73 petition for a new trial. It was in Cook versus United States. And granting the petition, this court concluded that evidence that the alleged victim engaged in an extramarital affair with another person discloses non-cumulative impeachment evidence that is relevant not only to a material issue in the case, but the dispositive issue in the case, in petitioner's case, the alleged victim's credibility.
So, counsel, if we find that it's cumulative, then does that end the inquiry if we apply that unpublished opinion?
So our position, Your Honor, is that all of that, whether it's cumulative, whether it's impeachment, how you tie it back to the specific facts of this case, is the third prong. And the problem is that the military judge never got there. That's how he abused his discretion. The military judge said that because he applied this categorical rule, because it's a post-trial event, it cannot possibly be newly discovered evidence. And we think that that is just clearly wrong. That is a clear abuse of discretion because it's a question of law, what test to apply, and the law clearly says that post-trial events. So Giambra is a recantation, post-trial recantation, purely post-trial act, considered as potentially new evidence. Key involved post-trial compensation for an undercover informant, again, a post-trial payment of money, considered as potentially new evidence. And Luke involved post-trial discipline of a forensic analyst 6 years after the trial. So the time bar issue aside, that's something that's far removed in time. Again, it was considered as to whether or not it creates a probability of producing a substantially more favorable result to the accused. That's the test.
Counsel, in Giambra, didn't the court really analyze it as a matter of fraud, though, because the recantation essentially indicated, or potentially indicated, what it presented to the court was a question of whether the testimony was false. Isn't that how they looked at it?
They did, Your Honor. The issue and what the court ended up doing there was remanding for further fact-finding, because the problem was one of these two statements is false. You have trial testimony saying one thing and post-trial statement saying the opposite, and the question is which is true. So that was a question of fact that had to be determined. But we think that the procedural posture of this case is very important to this court's action, because this is a preserved error. Because it's a right, the defense asked for this at trial, and the military judge applied the wrong test. He abused his discretion. That's a preserved error, and because it's a preserved error, the burden is on the government division to show that it is harmless. It is not our burden at this stage to show that the evidence would probably produce a substantially more favorable result. Rather, it is their burden to show that it probably would not have produced a substantially more favorable result. Now, the test for that is in 1210F2C, whether the evidence, if considered by a court-martial, in light of all other pertinent evidence, would probably produce a substantially more favorable result for the accused. That involves at least three considerations. And so the first is the evidence has to be considered in context, in light of all other pertinent evidence. In other words, it need not stand alone. The fact that it is a post-trial urinalysis, the fact that there is some, you know, perhaps room for debate as to whether or not the alleged victim in this case, Senior Airman MS, was in fact a casual user of drugs at the time of trial. When she claimed that she wasn't, she repeatedly said she was forced into using the drugs by Airman Scalufo, and that the only two times she had used drugs while in the military was with him. So the fact that 88 days after the trial ended, a urinalysis showed a positive result for marijuana, and then 13 days after that, a urinalysis showed a positive result for marijuana and cocaine, coupled with her contemporaneous admission to a colleague that she was doing it because of a chronic pain issue. So not a spontaneous decision to smoke marijuana and use cocaine, not because the trial was a traumatic experience, not some other recent event, but a long-term pain. Her exact words, as recounted by the witness.
Is that the relevance of her testimony then? Or I'm sorry, the relevance of this evidence is that it would impeach her credibility at trial?
So, yes, Your Honor, the relevance of the evidence is that it impeaches her credibility. And that is the dispositive issue in this case, because Airman Scalufo's convictions stand or fall entirely on her credibility.
And if the issue then is her credibility at trial, that is that she testified falsely at trial, why wouldn't this be analyzed under 1210F3 as a fraud on the court?
Because she... So I'm not saying it can't be analyzed under F3. Our position is that it is that the military judge abused his discretion when he applied a categorical bar to considering it as newly discovered evidence under 1210F2 because it involved events that occurred after trial. That was the military judge's first legal error. That was really the legal error, right? That's where he misapplied the law. He made erroneous findings of fact when he failed to consider the obstruction in conjunction with the urinalysis results. And then he made a decision outside the range of reasonable choices with his ultimate ruling.
So, counsel, I'd like to pick up on something you just mentioned, which is you say the military judge made erroneous findings of fact when he failed to address what you describe as the obstruction of justice. But is that really an erroneous finding of fact, or is that just a finding of fact that he declined to explicitly make? And is the significance of that simply that we're not bound by his view of it and that we can review that evidence de novo for ourselves?
Yes, we think that you're not bound, you're certainly not bound by the absence of the finding. In other words, that if you were to find that Senior MNMS did obstruct justice, you're not bound by some sort of finding of fact that says the opposite of that. But our position is that you are not required to do a de novo 1210F2 review. Rather, it's on the government division to prove that the military judge's abuse of discretion was harmless. They have to prove that the new evidence would not probably have produced a substantially more favorable result for the accused. And if they can't do that, then the appropriate remedy is to order a new trial. And that is because this is a preserved error. Now, there's certain evidence in this case that only the government presents that could perhaps bear on that question, whether or not Senior MNMS had participated in other urinalysis tests, what the results were afterward, whether or not she made other statements to criminal investigators or other people. But only the government has that evidence. And they're the only ones who had it at the time of the motion as well. They had the opportunity to present it and show that it would not have produced a substantially more favorable result. They failed to do so. They shouldn't get a second chance to do that now.
But I guess my question is, the simple fact that the military judge didn't address the statement from the individual that she spoke to, that doesn't make his other findings erroneous, does it?
Not necessarily, Your Honor, except that he doesn't make the other findings of fact erroneous. Right, so yes, he made other findings of fact, and some of them are supported by the record, some of them are within his discretion. The erroneous finding of fact we're pointing to is the omission of the consideration of this other misconduct, which we think is bearing upon the alleged victim's credibility. And when considered in light of all the other pertinent evidence, matters, because the other pertinent evidence includes the way these allegations arose. Right? These allegations arose after Senior Airman MS was accused of misconduct. Drug use, in fact. She had admitted to drug use, wrongfully using Adderall, smoking weed on the weekends, consumption of alcohol. And then, after making those admissions and being sent to security forces for an interview, she begins to make allegations that Airman Scalufo was physically abusive to her, and then eventually adds on after multiple statements that he was sexually abusive as well. We don't think it insignificant that Adderall is an amphetamine, like cocaine. There's a lot of linkage here between her earliest statements prior to implicating Airman Scalufo in any of the alleged acts and the final discovery of her recreational use of drugs, and that is what it is. She doesn't have some other place she can point to say she was coerced into smoking marijuana and using cocaine on those occasions. She admitted that she was using it because she enjoyed the effects. Those are the things that tie it back to this case. But again, we think that the burden is on them to show that it doesn't, because the issue was raised to the military judge. And I want to quickly turn to what the military judge actually said.
Counsel, before you do that, before you move on, I'm struggling with the RCM language that talks in F2, newly discovered evidence, that the petition must show these three things. The petition must show. That petition is from the appellant. And I'm trying to understand essentially the plain text of that and contrast that with the burden shifting that you're discussing. Could you inform me on that?
Yes, Your Honor. So the rule speaks of a petition as in a petition under Article 73. This is something separate from an Article 73 petition, as acknowledged by CAF in Webb, that a military judge has the authority to consider a request for a new trial, should apply the 1210 or must apply the 1210 criteria to that request, and then has authority outside of Article 73 to grant whatever relief is appropriate.
So your position is take the standard from the 1102, take the standard from the RCM, but don't take the burden language.
Well, our language is there was no petition.
Okay.
So we can't determine whether or not the petition raises when there is no petition. You could perhaps impute to that the motion, but again, this turns to what the military judge actually did. The military judge did not do the analysis, right? That is the abuse of discretion, that is the error of law. He said categorically, this cannot be new evidence, so I'm not going to do any more analysis. But then he turned and did the 1210 F3 analysis, and that's the analysis for a fraud on the court-martial. Now, the military judge sort of bifurcated the analysis and said, first, is there a fraud on the court-martial? And second, was it a substantial contributing factor in the conviction? Our position is the rule doesn't work that way. Our position is that the rule assumes that there was a fraud on the court and then looks to whether or not the fraud was a substantial contributing factor. So you don't get to substantial contributing factor unless there was a fraud upon the court-martial. And the military judge found there wasn't a fraud upon the court-martial, so we think his analysis departed from the rule at that point. But what he did say, and this was in his post-trial ruling, he wrote, the defense argues that the named victim characterized her marijuana use with the accused as being somehow forced or coerced by the accused as a result of his dominion and control over her. That was the trial strategy, right? And he notes, as opposed to merely a routine or recreational use. And he writes, while the defense's contention may have been a viable conclusion by a fact finder given the testimony at trial, this court finds that this conclusion, if made, would not constitute a substantial contributing factor. What's important there, Your Honors, is that he says that the contention may have been a viable conclusion by a fact finder. That is a probability of a substantially more favorable result for the accused. That is an acknowledgement that it could have worked. There is a probability there. And it is an important acknowledgement for two reasons. The first is that the military judge was the fact finder in this case. He was perfectly positioned to say, this would not have changed the result. This would not have affected the disposition of this case because of the other evidence. The second thing is that he didn't say that. What he doesn't say in this ruling speaks as loudly as what he does. He does not take the approach of assuming it's new evidence, it's harmless, it wouldn't have produced a different result. He instead says, it's not new evidence, and I'm going to analyze it under a different rule with language that suggests that it might have proved a more substantial, produced a substantially more favorable result. We analogize it to a prosecutorial misconduct issue. Right, on appeal, an appellate court can reject a claim of prosecutorial misconduct on the basis that it's harmless. You can assume error and find harmlessness. But you can't assume error and find prejudice. If you're going to find prejudice, you have to go back and actually see the error. In this case, the military judge, when he rejected this issue, he didn't do the analysis because he didn't find the error, because he didn't consider it.
What if we decline to make the leap that the two post-trial year analyses indicate casual drug use and instead conclude that they were simply two positive year analyses post-trial?
That's where her statement comes in, Your Honor. That's where the statement to Airman CW, the ironically initialed CW, which is Appellate Exhibit 20.
Right, where she tells him to not disclose the conversation.
Well, where he wrote, she explained to me that she had been in a lot of pain in her hips and back, and the doctors wouldn't prescribe her the meds she needed, so she had to self-medicate. She further explained smoking marijuana was the only thing helping her cope with the pain. Now, you know, when you look at the timeline in this case, it's 88 days between the day she gave her unsworn statement in sentencing and the positive urine analysis result. It was 90 days from the...
Assuming that the hip pain is correct, we don't know when that starts.
That's right, Your Honor.
We have to make this assumption that it all happened.
Well, it's not an assumption, Your Honor. It's a reasonable inference. The reasonable inference is to be drawn from that.
But if we don't make that inference, then where does your argument go?
Well, it goes to... So we don't think you're required to make that inference in the first instance because what you're presented with is a trial error, a preserved trial error. So we think that the government division has the burden to prove that you can't make that inference, that it's not a reasonable inference from that. If you were to not hold them to that burden, then you're doing a de novo review of the issue. We don't think it has to be dispositive. The standard is whether or not it probably would have produced a substantially more favorable result for the accused. Now, we have more favorable because we have an acquittal, substantially because we're talking full acquittal. His convictions, all of his convictions, stand or fall on her testimony. Would it probably have done that? If something had undermined her credibility, if all of those military witnesses who came in to testify about her good character had been able to be asked on cross-examination, did you know or have you heard that she's a casual user of marijuana? Is there a probability that would have changed the result? We say the answer to that is yes. I see that my time is about to expire. I will address the drug issue on rebuttal, absent any other questions now.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Government counsel, you may proceed.
Senior Judge Johnson, Judge Posch, and Judge Key. My name is Major Dale Perkle, and along with Ms. Mary Ellen Payne, I represent the United States in this matter. May it please the court. This court should hold that appellant's finding of guilty for charge one and its specification is legally and factually sufficient. This court should also find that a new trial on the grounds of newly discovered evidence is not warranted for the appellant. I'd like to begin by discussing issue two, which is whether or not the military judge abused his discretion in failing to order a new trial on the grounds of newly discovered evidence. It is the United States' position that the burden from RCM 1210F2 is on appellant in this case to prove that he warrants a new trial. And for several reasons, the appellant has failed to meet that burden. The appellant has not met the threshold to show that this evidence on its face is admissible or truly tailored new evidence as contemplated under RCM 1210. But assuming arguendo that this court finds it, this is some category of new evidence that could be considered under RCM 1210F2, this court should look to tests from the Federal Circuit or prior military precedent and United States v. Brady case law cited in the United States brief in crafting some sort of test to find a nexus between this post-trial conduct and the testimony at trial or evidence at trial, and that merely impeachment evidence would not be enough of a nexus to trial testimony to warrant a new trial. And finally, I will discuss why, when reviewing the record as a whole, including the testimony and argument by counsel at the post-trial 39A hearing, the military judge did not abuse his discretion in coming to the conclusion that a new trial was not an appropriate remedy for the appellant.
In your brief, you argued that this issue wasn't even before the court because there had been no petition for a new trial made. Are you abandoning that line of argument at this point?
Yes, Your Honor, in so much as under Article 39A, this court has the authority to review the military judge's ruling for abuse of discretion. Because appellant did not petition under Article 73, whether or not a de novo review would be applicable is really the point that the United States was making. And I think it is a factor to consider in looking at the appellant's burden. He had the remedy of also petitioning this court through Article 73, through TJAG, and chose not to. Instead, appellant asked for and was given a remedy, which is an Article 39A post-trial hearing, given the opportunity to be heard, given the opportunity to present evidence with the burden, and in doing so, limited himself to the findings of fact and conclusions of law of the military judge in that hearing. So he can't really have it both ways.
Counsel, before we move on, I just want to make sure you're not abandoning everything, or maybe you are. I think the question is, if we were to, can we legally order a new trial? If we utter that as a decretal, is that beyond the scope of what the President and the Congress has intended? Or on the other hand, would our decretal allow us to, I guess, set aside or dismiss without prejudice? In other words, if the point this court speaks and says we direct a new trial, have we gone beyond our authority?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that's an issue that's not been resolved. I believe that the case law that's cited by both appellant and trial counsel in this case show that the military judge had the authority to do that, and that you have the ability to review his ruling by abuse of discretion, but the available remedy to appellant beyond whether or not you find the judge abused his discretion is a case of first impression from the United States perspective.
If we didn't order a new trial, what other possible remedy would there be?
Well, Your Honor could order an additional post-trial hearing for further fact-finding or new evidence depending on where the abuse of discretion lied. If you were to find that, the United States believes that you in reviewing this record as a whole will not find there was an abuse of discretion by the military judge. So I'd like to start in looking at both the plain language of RCM 1210F2 and case law like United States versus Niles, including the senior defense counsel's concessions at the post-trial 39A that it is the defense's burden or the appellant's burden to prove that a new trial is warranted. I'd like to remind the court that this is a very high burden, and this remedy of a new trial is significant. It's disfavored absent manifest injustice. And so that needs to be overlaid in looking at all of the facts and circumstances of this case to ensure that we're looking at it through the lens of this incredibly high disfavored remedy for the appellant. So looking at the first factor, what is new evidence? In the post-trial 39A hearing, both the motions for the hearing and at oral argument, the military judge repeatedly asked appellant to provide case law to show why this is new evidence, and appellant did not. The first time appellant cited some case law that any post-trial conduct was relevant potentially to warrant a new trial was in its reply brief to this court. And I think it's important if you look at the record around starting at page 814, where the military judge really tries to focus the defense counsel on what is the evidence we're talking about to make concessions. And so the initial motion for post-trial hearing was related to statements by Senior Airman KP, her wife JP, and the PHA evidence, which the defense conceded at the hearing was not new evidence, not enough to warrant a new trial. So then he tried to further neck down what is the defense's position, what is appellant's now position about what is new evidence. So we're talking about marijuana and cocaine use on or about April and May of 2018, and the statements about that use to Senior Airman CW, and also her request to not discuss the conversation. Within those pieces of evidence, the military judge continued to press defense counsel about why he believed this was relevant, what about it had a nexus to trial. And he actually asked that during the hearing. If you look through on the record at page 791, he asked defense counsel, I'm not seeing it, cocaine didn't come up at trial. He was looking to see what came up at trial as impeachment evidence at 794.
So wasn't what the defense counsel was really saying is that what it shows is a course of conduct on the part of the victim that dates from before she joined the Air Force all the way past the trial. And how would you distinguish that from a case like Luke, which also examined allegations or information that came up well after the trial that pointed to a course of conduct on the part of a critical witness?
Yes, Your Honor. So the result of Luke was that the appellant was not actually, even with that sort of evidence, appellant was not granted a new trial. And so in so much as the court reads Luke to show that that type of evidence could be considered new evidence, it wasn't enough, again, to overcome the threshold. But with regard to your...
Well, but at least the appellant made it to the third step of the analysis, correct? It
wasn't
dismissed that this isn't the type of thing that warrants looking at a new trial.
Yes, Your Honor. And so in Luke, the CAF found that the finding of fact by the judge was clearly erroneous, that the thoroughness issues did not have a nexus to trial. And so the CAF was looking for a nexus to trial in Luke and found it through the thoroughness. Although they did look to MRE 608 to see about the admissibility of this, and that it would not be admissible under credibility or opinion testimony, and that this was merely impeachment evidence. And that was the conclusion CAF came to, was under this third prong, this was merely impeachment evidence and it wouldn't warrant a new trial. And so arguably, the appellant has not made the sufficient nexus for the admissibility of this evidence at trial. Is it character for drug use that the appellant wants to admit it for? What does this evidence look like? Are they trying to get extrinsic evidence in? Are they trying to just cross-examine her on her use? Are they trying to put it in? What about a 403 balancing test?
Well, she testified that she had only used twice during her service, and the evidence indicates otherwise, that she had been casually using throughout her service. I think the issue is pretty squarely in front of the fact finder at that point in time because it goes straight to her credibility.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, the United States believes that her statements about use in April and May of 2008 do not impeach her statements that she made in January that she had only used twice in the military. It is not an inconsistent statement. They're unrelated. That it is a true statement that in, we have no evidence to the contrary that in January of 2018, when she testified under oath, that she had only smoked marijuana twice. Several months later, she's found to have smoked marijuana in the future. It does not impeach her testimony in January, and it does not impeach what she said she did with appellant in May, June, July, August of 2016, which is specification one of charge one.
As long as we don't draw the inference appellant is asking us to.
Yes, Your Honor. The United States believes it's an improper inference, improper character evidence, and to the extent that it's cumulative is also important. So she was cross-examined extensively at trial about her drug use, her use of Adderall, her pre-service use of marijuana, her underage drinking, all of that came out. And so to the extent that there would be one more question about additional marijuana use, it really factors into the third prong of why it would not rise to the level of warranting a new trial. And really, is nothing new to the trier of fact that this individual used marijuana. And it's nothing new to the character witnesses who testified on her behalf for character of truthfulness that this individual used marijuana. In fact, we have no reason to believe that if confronted with this evidence at trial, she would have lied about it, or that she did lie about it, because she was completely honest at trial, before trial, about her own misconduct. She's facing criminal or administrative charges on her own for her own misconduct, which actually makes her more credible. And to the extent that appellant now says his convictions for marijuana use are factually and legally insufficient, the fact that he is then dating a recreational drug user actually hurts his case should this go back to trial. And so the United States believes in total that this evidence is potentially not even admissible. So were this court to warrant a new trial and the trial judge say under 403 or otherwise that this does not rise to the level of appropriate character evidence, then the appellant would get a second bite at the apple for no reason.
It seems to me that if we do send this case back, if it does go for a new trial, this is going to come squarely into evidence because you now have the victim in the case having made sworn statements that she had not used drugs during her time in the service other than the Adderall and the two marijuana uses. And if there is further evidence, whether through an inference or otherwise, that she had in fact used more than those times, then I think that that would squarely go to her credibility in any subsequent trial. But as I look at this case, most of the evidence, if not all of it, falls squarely on the credibility of the victim and squarely on her shoulders and her testimony. So I would like to know what the government's position as to why this case isn't like Cook versus the United States, where the victim's credibility is the dispositive evidence in the case. It's not merely a collateral issue.
Yes, Your Honor. This case is predominantly the testimony of the victim. However, the prosecution exhibits 1 through 6 are corroboration of the victim's testimony. It's not just her testimony that we have. We have statements of the accused in text message conversations where the victim says, "You hit me again," and the accused does not deny that, does not deny his actions in physical abuse, which he was convicted of 7 counts of assault consummated by a battery. And you have the photographs of her injuries and her testimony about it. So it's not just her credibility in court where she testified that he did A, B, and C in this time frame, but she had photographs and text messages to back that up. And to presume that she fabricated these photographs and text messages is a leap too far, and that the trier of fact selected by appellant, the judge in this case, found her to be credible. And there were 5 witnesses willing to take the stand and say, she's a truthful person. She admitted herself that she occasionally exaggerates, which again leads credibility to the fact that she takes responsibility for what she does wrong, but it doesn't change the fact.
But counsel, doesn't that kind of go to Judge Key's point that prosecution really did rely on her credibility, and the judge relied on her credibility, and now we're in a position, potentially, if we make the inference that the defense would have us make, that significantly undermines that credibility.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think the key there, then, is to focus on the fact that this is non-cumulative impeachment. It's not as if her credibility were not questioned at trial. It's not as if there was no cross-examination about drug use, even, at trial. Those facts were at issue. The military judge considered them in findings. And so, unlike other cases where the individual covered up an affair and no one ever questioned her credibility, that's not the case here, and that's why it's distinguishable. This is not uncontroverted. It's not new. It was litigated at trial. Appellant had the opportunity to present those witnesses, and still the trier of fact found her credible. So again, one more question about additional drug use, in the United States opinion, would not tip the balance. So just a few facts briefly about why we believe the military judge did not abuse his discretion. He, on page 797 of the record, he says, whatever, again, that kind of goes back to my original question. Do we track the behavior of witnesses in a court-martial if they do something wrong? Because if a witness goes off and does whatever, it doesn't undercut the proceedings unless there's a specific factual nexus to the proceeding. So that is a very important term that the military judge understands the law that's applicable in this case and is asking counsel to explain it to him. He considered the admissibility of the proffered evidence. He looked to what had already come up for a trial. He limited the defense to what evidence actually mattered. So part of the appellant's contention now is that the judge's findings of fact are erroneous because he omitted facts. But the defense at the post-trial 39A actually conceded the only relevant facts at the end of the day, the only relevant facts are her credibility, her drug use, and her statements about her drug use. And so it's not surprising that when the military judge made findings of fact, he did not address the obstruction of justice specifically or the other acts, because trial defense counsel conceded that that was not the point of their motion and that was not what would, in their mind, constitute a new trial. There are no other questions about this issue. I'd like to move on to the second issue. So the question the court granted is whether or not the findings of guilty of charge one and its specification are legally and factually sufficient. I'd like to first discuss which words were accepted and substituted, because I think it's an important discussion to have about what language we're discussing here. So the accepted words were on diverse occasions. And the final specification, if the accepted words and substituted words are put together, would read that the appellant did at or near Joint Base San Antonio Lackland, Texas, at a party to celebrate appellant's birthday, occurring just prior to 3 August 2016, between on or about 1 July 2016 and 4 August 2016, wrongfully used marijuana. That is the specification of which the appellant was found guilty. In that specification, we have dates just prior to 3 August and between on or about 1 July and 4 August. What's important is that the judge accepted the words on diverse occasion and found appellant guilty of one marijuana use. And he found appellant guilty of one marijuana use at a party to celebrate his birthday.
Counsel, are you conceding that the judge intended to find the second alleged use?
Yes, Your Honor. And the facts, as the victim testified to, make it very clear the difference in the uses. So the first use was in the morning at appellant's own apartment. It was a smaller blunt, about 3 inches. She was doing dishes, her hands were wet. It was a very specific memory about that use. The second use, she said at trial, it was at a party to celebrate his birthday, and that's in the record on page 268. And so it's very clear from the facts that the two uses, one in the morning while doing dishes, one in the morning at a party to celebrate his birthday, that the military judge convicted the appellant of the second use.
But he also said he specifically identified it as occurring before the 3rd of August, and the evidence indicated that the party was not before the 3rd of August.
Yes, Your Honor. So there's the initial testimony of the victim was that she didn't remember the date of the use, that it occurred around his at a party to celebrate his birthday, and that it wasn't on his birthday, which was 3 August. When pressed by counsel, both trial counsel and defense counsel, she eventually said it was 5 August. But there is some evidence in the record to show that she was unclear about the date initially, and that the date really doesn't matter. And the United States position is that the date is not an element of the offense. So the United States would ask this court by assertions and substitutions to cross off the words occurring just prior to 3 August 2016 and find that this specification is factually and legally sufficient.
So in light of English, how do we have the authority to expand the scope of a specification at our level?
Well, Your Honor, the United States does not believe that you're expanding the scope of the specification because the date range still exists. And the only accepted words were diverse use. So you're not changing the criminality of the specification by saying this is still one use, this is still one use at a party to celebrate his birthday. We're just looking at when did that party occur, which is not an element of the offense. And so English said that you cannot use Article 66 powers to find the appellant guilty with exceptions and substitutions based on a theory of criminality not presented to the trier of fact. That is the holding of English. And so it's not about expanding or contracting the time frame. It's about the theory of criminality.
But the judge was very specific. I mean, he didn't have to identify that this use occurred before the 3rd of August, but he did. And doesn't that constrain his finding?
Well, Your Honor, he also didn't have to say that it was at a birthday party to celebrate.
Indeed, he did not.
Yes, Your Honor. And so the United States position is that it's clear what the theory of guilt that the trier of fact found was beyond a reasonable doubt, and that was at a party to celebrate appellant's birthday. And this court has in the past, on multiple occasions, allowed for variance, non-fatal variance, with respect to dates. And so here we just have an issue of when did that party occur. We don't have a due process concern. So a lot of what English talked about was the due process concern and the ability to defend himself at trial. Appellant was able to defend himself to a use of marijuana at a party to celebrate his birthday. He called other witnesses to say there was no marijuana there. The government called the victim to say there was.
I guess the distinction is in most of the case law, what we're talking about is how the proof comes out as it pertains to the charged offense. Here we've got the fact finder, the judge, substituting in very specific language. And what the government is asking us to do is to go back and rewrite that finding.
Yes, Your Honor, we're asking you to find a factually and legally sufficient theory of criminality based on the facts presented to the trier of fact, which are that appellant smoked marijuana at a party to celebrate his birthday at or near Joint Base San Antonio Lackland. That is what we're asking you to do. And we believe the case law not only allows you to do that, but it is consistent with Walters, it's consistent with Hale, it's consistent with English, that we're looking not just to the dates, which are not an element.
So what examples do you have of a court of criminal appeals doing what you're asking us to do now?
I don't have any specific examples, Your Honor, other than the case law like Hale and even Walters, where the court talks about a finding by exceptions and substitutions that removes diverse occasions must clearly reflect the specific instance of conduct on which the modified language is based through reference in the substituted language to a date or the facts in evidence that will clearly put the accused and the reviewing courts on notice of the conduct. And so what we're asking you to do is not inconsistent with that. We're looking at the facts of this use. We know it was at a party to celebrate his birthday. We know who it was. We know where it was. And the only question is when. And we're, you know, some of the date variance cases allow for variance up to a year. And here we're talking about a matter of days.
So to be clear, you are asking us to modify the specification, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
If this is a sufficient specification, why would we need to modify it?
Well, Your Honor, just for the same reason modifications were made in Hale to understand the facts presented at trial and the specification on its face.
Well, in Hale, what the court didn't do was take a legally insufficient specification and modify it to become legally sufficient, which if the evidence indicates that the party was on the 5th of August and that's not what the judge found when the use occurred, isn't that what you're asking us to do, is to fix a legally insufficient specification?
Well, Your Honor, the United States believes there is some evidence in the record to support that the party occurred on a date other than 5 August. There is some testimony that the victim provided that she was certain it wasn't on his birthday. She knew it was at around his birthday. And even in her direct examination, trial counsel asked her, on 5 August or whenever the party was. It wasn't a very specific point at trial that it had to be on 5 August.
But if that's what the evidence supports, why can't we just affirm it and say that's what the judge must have found?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, affirm?
The specification as it is.
That is certainly within the purview of this court.
But that's not what you're recommending?
The United States recommends accepting out the words occurring just prior to 3 August. I will briefly address the credibility. I know we've talked a little bit about the credibility of Senior Airman MS, but that is the basis of the factual insufficiency assignment of error raised by appellant. And we would point to United States versus GUEU, that not all testimony needs to be consistent in order to be factually sufficient. And so appellant has provided a thorough table of what they believe to be inconsistencies. Some of these inconsistencies are not supported by evidence that was presented on the merits. This court is limited to reviewing factual legal sufficiency to evidence presented on the merits. In so much as there are minor inconsistencies, we're not looking at inconsistencies about major issues. We are like Kim. We need to look and see that the trier of fact saw the victim's testimony and found her to be credible. The United States does not say this court must do that, but that it should. It should, as a matter of credibility, make allowances for the fact that the trier of fact viewed this victim's testimony at trial and found her to be credible. In addition, there were 5 witnesses that testified to her character for truthfulness at trial, and there were 4 that testified against. To the extent that this was litigated, we've discussed, and appellants argument that she was doing this all out of revenge was their first argument, and the second that she did it to cover up her own misconduct is simply not supported by the record. Revenge does not allow for an individual to fabricate prosecution's exhibit 1-6, photographs and text messages of the appellant, and the fact that she was trying to cover up her own misconduct doesn't hold water because she in fact was facing discipline for her own misconduct. And so, in so much as those are their theories that the United States has not rebutted, the United States believes that we have, specifically because they're just not supported by the testimony or the record. So if there are no more questions, the United States believes that appellant's conviction for wrongful use of marijuana at a party to celebrate his birthday is both factually and legally sufficient. Viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the government and drawing all reasonable inferences in favor of the government, we believe that we have shown all the evidence beyond a reasonable doubt, and this court should uphold his conviction for charge 1 and specification. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Appellant counsel.
Mr. Spillman, one of the questions that it seems like is before us on this I'd like you to address is, unlike Cook, where the adultery, if you will, was a surprise, the issue at trial in this case about the alleged manipulation, the lying, was before the fact finder. And it seems like the new evidence that you would have us find just is just more of that. And in that respect, this is different than Cook, is it not?
I'm sorry, is it?
This is different than Cook.
No, Your Honor, actually we think it's very much like Cook, and I'd like to read, if I could, a brief passage from Cook, which is found at Star 8 in the Lexis pagination. That's at 2017 CCA Lexis 144. And it reads, after trial defense counsel attacked Technical Sergeant LT, so the alleged victim's credibility on cross-examination, the government presented three witnesses, an officer and two non-commissioned officers, who offered positive opinions of Technical Sergeant LT's character for truthfulness. The exact same thing happened in this case. In this case, the defense counsel attacked Senior Airman MS's credibility based on prior inconsistent statements, motives to fabricate, things like that. And in response, the prosecution called a bunch of witnesses to testify about her character for truthfulness. These were her supervisors. These were the people who worked with her. The defense, in its case in chief, called other people, friends, peers, more junior individuals, to testify that she was an untruthful person. And so there was a battle on that. But this additional factor would directly bear on that, and particularly on the testimony of her superiors that were basing their observations on her performance of duty. A performance of duty, by the way, that we do not agree that she was facing some sort of disciplinary action for her misconduct. She blamed her misconduct on Airman Scalufo. She said he forced her to use the marijuana, and he tricked her to use the Adderall. We think that those things are directly rebutted by the post-trial discoveries. I said I'd get to the 112 alpha, and I'd like to try and start there, please. This is not a notice case, Your Honors. This is a findings case, and you need look no further than the first sentence of Article 66C. In a case referred to it, the Court of Criminal Appeals may act only with respect to the findings and sentence as approved by the convening authority. The findings as approved by the convening authority in this case were that the drug use occurred shortly before 3 August 2016, that's when the party was. There is no reasonable dispute over when the party was. I can cite to the record if Your Honors are not convinced on that, but it is clear. Senior Airman MS wasn't sure what day of the week 3 August 2016, the day of the birthday, was, but she was sure that the party came after. It was the Friday after. The other witnesses were also sure. And that date, 5 August 2016, was outside of the charged range. It was on or about 1 July 2016 and 4 August and 16. Not on or about 4 August and 16. So you have to read out part of the finding, and you really can't do that. Article 66C says you can't do that. English says you can't do that. We don't agree that English stands for the proposition that it's about the theory presented to the trier of fact. We believe that English forbids changing a conviction to remove narrowing language. In English, there was narrowing language about the means of bodily harm. Here, there is narrowing language about the place and date of the alleged act. You can't change the spec to remove that. But even if you could, you know, even if you were to delete just the just before 3 August, you end up with a Walters issue. Because so now counsel, you have an ambiguous finding.
Your approach is that the announcement of findings was ambiguous.
No, Your Honor. Our position is the announcement of findings was clear, and there is no evidence to support the finding that there was a party shortly before 3 August 2016. A legally insufficient finding is a legally insufficient finding, and this is a legally insufficient finding. They happen sometimes. The trier of fact got it wrong. There's no evidence to support that finding, and so it cannot stand. Even if there were some evidence, it's factually insufficient for all the other reasons we've discussed. I want to turn back to the petition for the 1210 issue, if I could, please. The standard is not a manifest injustice. That's a standard that comes from the federal civil law that applies a different rule with different tests and different case law. The standard, nowhere in Article 73 or RCM 1210 do you see the requirement for a manifest injustice. So that's not the standard, and that's not what this case is about. This is also not a Brady case, Your Honors. This isn't about disclosure. This isn't about whether or not the government hid evidence. This is about whether or not post-trial events can provide new evidence justifying the analysis under 1210F2, and whether or not the military judge abused his discretion. That's the issue specified for oral argument. Whether or not the military judge abused his discretion when he failed to apply the correct test. To say that the government division concedes that it's abuse of discretion. It's not a de novo review. It's not a plain error review. You're reviewing the military judge's ruling for an abuse of discretion, and he applied the incorrect law. That's ipso facto an abuse of discretion because there is no discretion for a judge to misapply the law. To say that there's no remedy for that would create this, would turn this into an error without remedy. There has to be a remedy for that. And the remedy is found in well-settled appellate procedure. When there's a preserved trial error, the government division, the party that benefited from that error at trial, has the burden to prove it harmless if they want to salvage the conviction. They can't and haven't done that here. And we say they can't do it because of the nature of the judge's actual findings, because he acknowledged that the defense's contention may have been a viable conclusion by a fact finder given the testimony at trial. That gets you to the probability of producing a better result. And in part of why it does is the difference. I'd like to note two additional points, which is the difference between new evidence and a fraud on the court-martial. A fraud on the court-martial does not require something to be discovered after trial, and it does not require clean hands by the defense, but it involves a substantially higher burden to justify the new trial. So there are different considerations, right? A fraud on the court-martial can be based on something that was known before or partially known before. There isn't that initial requirement of newly discovered evidence that couldn't have been discovered by due diligence. Those first two requirements aren't there. But there is the requirement that there be a substantial contributing factor to the conviction. So there are different tests, different standards addressing different things. That's another error by the military judge. Finally, I'd like to address this other evidence that my friend on the other side talked about. In our brief on page 21, we addressed the text messages that were introduced. The text messages, the source of those, was Senior Airman MS. There were hundreds, if not thousands, that she admitted that she deleted, and the agent who recovered them said, yes, she could have modified them. She could have deleted the ones where he said, what are you talking about? I didn't do that. And finally, I'll leave it at that, Your Honors, absent any other questions.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel, thank you both for your arguments. The court will render a decision in due course. The court is now closed.
All rise.